The reason this happened in Copenhagen first is because it changed, I would argue, so quickly. Copenhagen was a city that had very few cars in it going into World War II. The deprivations of World War II and the recession that followed from Northern Europe meant that people didn't start buying cars in a big way until the 50s, well into the 50s. So it wasn't until the late 50s that even just the few cars that had been bought by that point were choking the streets, because these are ancient medieval streets that don't have a lot of space on them to begin with. And Copenhagen, I think because they could still remember what it was like to live in a city that was not this crowded with cars, decided, rather than getting everything out of the way of cars, to get the cars out of the way. Copenhagen was one of the first cities to deliberately do this, starting in 1962, pedestrianizing its downtown block by block. They began with the main street, the Strøget, which is the great pedestrian street that now runs right through the center of Copenhagen. I should mention that this was hugely unpopular with most of the local populace when it was presented. A number of the merchants on this street closed up shop and moved onto side streets because they were convinced that with the cars gone, no one would shop there anymore. For average Copenhageners, the argument was, you know, we are Danes, not Italians. This is a cold, dark, northern culture. We want to, you know, Hamlet, the great Dane, sitting inside thinking, is it even worth going on? We're not going to sit out at some cafe like an Italian. What are you doing to us? This is not our culture. But as Jan Gehl, the urban design guru of Copenhagen, likes to say, climates and cultures may differ, but people are people. If you give them great space to sit in and see other people, they'll use it. And that really is what's happened across all of downtown Copenhagen and then beyond, is that the more space opened up, the more Copenhageners realized they were a lot like Italians after all. And in particular, in a northern climate, probably almost more so. This is a great example of it. This is, I took this picture in a kind of a chilly day in May, and it's a maritime city. So when it's chilly in Copenhagen, that wind just cuts through you like a knife. And still, though, the sun is out. And so when the sun is out, even if it's a little chilly, every cafe in Copenhagen, and actually every cafe now in Denmark, because all the Danish cities now do this, they leave out free blankets for you. These fleece blankets, usually sponsored by a beer company, so it's like Carlsberg or Tuborg or one of those. And you sit out and enjoy the sunshine and, you know, the fresh air and all that stuff, and you keep warm under a blanket and you have your glass of wine or your cup of coffee or whatever you want to do. And what they've demonstrated across the city is that all of this space that they thought was not useful in a northern climate is actually, you know, spectacular public space. This is a great example. This is right down on the waterfront. This was a parking lot until 1980. There was literally like diagonally parked cars the entire length of it. Now when you go there, it's packed because it's the last place where sunlight shines during the day. It's where the last place that gets direct sunlight. And those candy-colored warehouse buildings are now like the postcard image of the city. It's deep in their identity now that this is who we are. We are these people, you know, who sit out at cafes in front of these old waterfront buildings. The great thing is that this has spread, too. And Copenhagen will demonstrate to you time and again that this is not just for that little inner-city dense core. A great example of this is a thing that I do regularly because I, you know, I'm a bit of a transit geek. I love riding commuter rail and subways and the rest of it. And I will insist on figuring out how to get to a place for a meeting by transit, even though you wind up in a place that, you know, is supposed to be park and ride. So you're traversing these big empty parking lots and it's, you know, you feel like you're kind of lost in the wilderness. And that's what I was assuming. I did this once at a meeting in Copenhagen, way out at the end of one of the commuter rail lines. And I, you know, as I'm riding along thinking this is going to be another one of these things where I feel like a trespasser in a parking lot. Of course, I got there, and quite the opposite. Even deep in suburban Copenhagen, they've found space on the street for all the other ways to get around. And what this does is it allows you to walk from the office park to your commuter train. It allows people to bike, so you take your bike on the train and then finish the journey on a bike or whatever else you want to do. And for this and a million other reasons, as I said, Copenhagen is one of the world's great biking cities. And literally half of the downtown residents, 35% of the entire city's commuters travel by bike for at least part of the journey. And it's not just that they have good bike good streets and the rest of it. And a big part of it is that natural sort of human inclination for comfort and safety. This is a great example of it. We're coming up to one of the busiest intersections in Copenhagen. One of the things we tend to do as people when we want to separate people from things that are dangerous is plant things. So you've got a median strip there full of trees that are protecting the people and the bikes from the cars. I don't know how much of a debate you're having around here. Certainly in Calgary and a lot of other cities, the whether bikes belong on the roads is a huge debate, and whether it's safe. If you're at all involved in that debate, be clear, the only thing that matters in that debate is, can you protect people on bikes from cars? If you can do that, more and more people will ride bikes. It's been proven time and time again. It was proven in Copenhagen. They discovered, for example, that this particular intersection was very, very dangerous because of what's known in cycling circles as the right hook, which is that the light goes green, everyone sets out into the intersection, the car gets out first, turns right, and pegs off a cyclist. And so they solved it by the miracle of modern technology known as a traffic light. You can see right now the car's got a right, got permission to go right, and the bikes have to wait. A moment later, the bikes have the right of way. This is the kind of solution you come to if you're actually committed to making that space usable for more than cars. You use the exact same tools. In the case of Copenhagen, one of the things they did was they set up one of the main commuter arteries so that all the traffic lights are synced at biking speed. We now do this, you know, all over North America for automobiles, where all the lights are synced. So you come from a, you come to a stop at a red light, it goes green, and if you drive roughly the speed limit, you hit green after green after green, and you get to your off ramp and then your freeway. You can do the exact same thing for bikes. Even in Copenhagen, by the way, when they did this, some of the city planners were like, "This is not going to work. People don't all ride at the same speed. They don't all do this thing in the same way." And what they found, by the way, this is just a counter to remind people that there's lots of them. That's another thing you can do. But what they found was that, in fact, once you built the infrastructure properly, people would kind of adapt to the speed and the pace of everyone else, and it works absolutely beautifully. Part of the reason why it's such a great city to ride a bike in. And so that brings us back to the problem we have here in Alberta. Which is even in our densest of cities, my hometown of Calgary, for example, we remain with an 80% larger carbon footprint, largely auto-dependent, with a whole lot of challenges facing us. But what I was hoping to do is demonstrate that as city dwellers, and I am one, there is a land ethic emerging that is just as much about treading lighter, showing more respect for the space, showing more respect for the land, and more than anything, that if we're going to get to where we need to get to in the next generation or two, we are going to have to make our cities work just as well as our farms do, just as well as our natural spaces do. And in fact, a lot of the strain on our rural spaces is a direct product of the unsustainable stuff we're doing in our cities, and that's where we can actually make a lot of really great victories. And I had an occasion to think hard about this morning at 6 a.m. as I was getting up to leave Calgary and feeling truly like I had abandoned my own personal land ethic, because rather than get on the C train that goes near my house and begin my journey that way, which I do as often as I can, I had to get in a car. There's no other practical way to get from Calgary to here than in a car. You'd have to really want to not do it. But the infrastructure is there to be able to, if you kind of piece it together. So this is my little fantasy journey of a sustainable urban land ethic that gets me from Calgary to here and back again without hydrocarbons. But you're going to have to use your imagination. We begin, though, with the true fact that Calgary's actually done some really, really great stuff on this front. The C train in Calgary is wind powered. They built wind turbines specifically to provide sufficient energy to offset the amount of power the C train and the rest of the city's municipal infrastructure needed. So I could begin my journey on a C train, get to this amazing thing which we no longer have in Alberta, which is called a train station. We used to have them all over the place, and then we decided we had no interest in traveling by rail anymore, apparently. And so now there's very, very few of them, and they're wildly inconvenient, and they don't go anywhere. Except if you want a tourist train from one place to the other or something like that. But imagine I was able to get to a train station. Imagine we had built out enough renewable energy in this province, and we have the resources, that we could power not just the C train, but a state-of-the-art high-speed rail train. From Calgary to Edmonton. Thanks. For those of you who don't know, the rest of the world, when they think about the next generation of infrastructure, are not looking at building ring roads or widening highways. They are building high-speed rail. We have studied the hell out of high-speed rail in Canada, there are two places that it makes logical sense to start building tomorrow. One of them, as you can probably guess, is southern Ontario to southern Quebec, basically Toronto to Montreal or thereabouts. And the other one, we know that there would be the demand and the traffic, is Calgary to Edmonton. So imagine I was able to get onto a high-speed train. It's electrified. It runs on renewable energy. I get in the train station at Calgary. I arrive an hour later in the center of Edmonton. An hour later, that would be the travel time from Calgary to Edmonton by high-speed rail. And then, because we've decided, actually, that trains are a pretty good way to get around, we've also built a regional rail network so that I could have got on something like this, which regularly ferries Danes from small town to small town, and finished my journey that way. And then I would have been able to arrive here much better rested, not with that weird state of agitation you get after 3 hours on a highway. And I would have come the whole way without having to fire up an internal combustion engine. By the way, I do like to point this out for Canadian audiences because we think we're a special case here. When you ride regional rail, even in a place like Denmark, it's not going from huge city to huge city. This particular train, which I took, went from a town of 5,000 to a town of 20,000. And just sort of ran back and forth. And I'm reasonably sure if we had the wherewithal, we could figure out how to make it work here. Particularly given that this is a young, energetic, bright, innovative province with a lot of wealth right now. Surely we can do more with that wealth than simply figure out how to get more stuff out of the ground as fast as possible and accelerate the process by which we are deepening the climate crisis. I honestly do believe, thank you. I really do believe that we can lead this conversation. I think that, hopefully what you've seen today is that there's already a lot of leadership in this province. There are a lot of great voices, a lot of terrific ideas, some fantastic community that just, I think, needs, to keep pushing at it. It's cliche to say that, what you need to do is get involved, but that is what you need to do. And a lot of you, I think, are already on one level or other, but, beginning those conversations in the community, it's one thing to do what you can on an individual level, but we are so much more powerful as groups of citizens than as individuals. It's also cliche, but I'll ask anyway, how many people in this room voted in the recent municipal election? Just a show of hands. Not bad. Probably a little better than the provincial average. Even when it seems like there's no one worth spending the time for, some of this stuff does need more than just good ideas at the local level. It does need real leadership, and there's not a lot of real leadership in politics these days, and there won't be until we demand it. Lots of us, vociferously, repeatedly, for years. That is how you build political movements. That is how you create long-term lasting change, is by simply not taking no for an answer for a long time. So I would strongly encourage you, whatever else you're doing, to get involved on a community project, to find, there has to be one in every community, a politician worth spending your time on, and help that person get elected so that you have a collective voice in decision-making at whatever level you choose is the one that is most passionate to you. And then I do believe we will start to see even greater change in this province. Once it happens, I'd love to hear from you. So this is one way to get a hold of me. If you go to the website, there's contact information, lots of information about the book and everything else. And if you have joined me in the mass time waste that is Twitter, I'm on there quite a lot. So you can definitely keep up to date with what I'm working on there. Again, this has been way more of a learning experience for me than anything I could have possibly told you. This is my second time now to this campus. It feels like one of the little engines of that change we need in this province and in this country. I think there's some really great ideas, and thank you for sharing them with me.